And Jack, Jack Broadband, if you're ready, we'd like to have your briefing on number five, with the briefing of the agency collaboration on encouraging healthy infill development. Jack?
Okay.
If you would like, I can introduce this.
That would be great, Rob. Thank you.
Helpful. As you all know, the most important responsibility of the Joint Policy Committee is to foster coordination between the four JPC member agencies. At the most basic level, we don't want to have one agency requiring something that another prohibits. Ideally, all four agencies should be pulling in the same direction, each using its resources and authority to achieve shared objectives. Recently, a situation arose where ABAG took an action that the Air District believed could undermine its ability to achieve its mandated responsibilities. So, as called for in the processes you've adopted for dealing with such problems, the executive staff of the four agencies met to discuss this matter and then brought the matter to your executive committee for further resolution. We believe we have reached a satisfactory solution, and Jack Broadbent from the Air District and Ezra Report from ABAG will provide you with some additional information on the issue and the resolution agreement.
Thanks, Trav. First of all, I wanted to mention that I think we had a very good and very thorough, comprehensive discussion at the Executive Committee on this item just last week, and so I did want to mention for the JPC members here today that your executive committee that I thought had a very robust discussion that ultimately resulted in, I think, a good understanding of where we are. Probably, if you all don't mind, and I know you need to kill a little bit of time, so I'll give a little bit of background on this one, and I'll look to my chair and my board members to add to my remarks. Ezra, then I'll also hand it over to you. How about that? So what we're talking about are some CEQA guidelines that the board, the Air District's board, adopted back in the summer of 2010 down in San Jose. We had some litigation filed against the district by the Building Industry Association in the winter of 2010. And since then, we've been seeking to be able to resolve our litigation. And there's a number of issues associated with that litigation that obviously I can't go into. But at the heart of, I think, much of what this issue is about that we talked about at the Executive Committee is the fact that the CEQA guidelines were intended to be able to put in the hands of local governments tools that would allow them to deal with local impacts when they're approving essentially development, when they are approving a residential development, a commercial development down into an otherwise polluted community. We had a series of tools put in place, some assessment tools and mitigation tools to deal with those air quality impacts. Those are of concern to the this association. In fact, coincidentally enough, Mr. Campos has just walked in the door, so he's someone who we talked to quite a bit about this. And so what is that litigation is continuing to move forward. As I mentioned, I can't really necessarily talk about that, but what we did do, though, is we have sought to be able to develop and start a process, we believe, that will begin to really address that which is our intent under the CEQA guidelines, and that's to put in some tools that will help local governments as they are approving projects. And so we have yet to define what that process is called. Well, in the very short term, we're going to call it Gene's process, since Gene Roggenkamp, my deputy, is heading that effort. And I can talk to you a little bit more about that, and the executive committee certainly talked about it. But on the issue that was raised specifically, this litigation has been moving forward. ABAG has felt, I think, Ezra, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you have felt that we weren't resolving the issues associated with litigation as soon as we should, and has frankly seen a window of opportunity to be able to, I think, address some of the concerns with and raising these potential suggestions to the governor that could be providing some guidance to the OPR. And let me pause there, Ezra. Let me hand it over to you, because I think how this all came about was, frankly, some actions that I think, Ezra, you were taking.
Right. Where we have consensus, and this was discussed at the executive committee, is that there needs to be a land use regulation program that takes into account the quality of air in neighborhoods and PDAs where we're expecting new development to occur. And that process of land use regulation is under the control of the authority of the city. And the cities who are our members need clear guidance as to what should be the appropriate analysis and trade-offs, disclosures and mitigations before making any decision or applying conditions of approval to the project. Where there is still not consensus is the use of CEQA as a tool for this type of activity. There's a variety of reasons for that, but most of them are due to the imperfection of the CEQA process and the litigation that comes from CEQA as a threat that chills people for investors from going into areas where they think their CEQA clearance may become an issue or be litigated. The courts have looked carefully at the CEQA guidelines that have been promulgated by the state, and we felt that in light of these series of cases that the state should consider its revision process to bring some clarity to whether the state believes this guideline is still operable or not. Because without that, we have a complete split of confusion where some are saying it's not operable and some are saying it is, as long as the guideline's still there. So all we wanted was some clarity, because we can't do anything without that. But we've agreed not to agendize this item through February because of the lawsuit that's pending and the fact that it would reopen a whole series of arguments that have already been heard both at the Air Board and at the court. So that was the essential compromise, that the revision request was made. We will have no public items on it anymore through February, and the procedure to try to get a high-level ABAG air district land use regulation guide set of guidelines will be emphasized and brought to the JPC in probably around January, February.
Jack, you got to...
Yeah, Tom, let me make sure I close up, at least from my remarks, and also clarify a couple of comments. So at the heart of this is really being able to put in the hands of local governments and planners means in which they can address the concerns that, frankly, what the CEQA guidelines were attempting to try to address. And that is, as you approve developments in and around a freeway, for example, you have high air pollutant levels, and you're really putting potentially people at risk. That is actually the issue that's the litigation. And so we have, through our discussions at the executive committee, described a process that we think makes a lot of sense. And if you don't mind, Ezra, I'll mention, just expand on your remarks. What we've committed to do is frankly get planners in the room and develop a set of tools that can be provided to local planners that indeed will address this issue that we're talking about. And that's the genes process that I was mentioning earlier. We'll come up with a name, but this is development guidelines. This is setbacks. This is HEPA filters on buildings right up next to a freeway. There's a variety of things that we think we can identify, put in, and recommend for local jurisdictions to be undertaking when they approve these developments. And this will be a collaborative effort that's done by all four agencies, and it'll be something that we bring back to the JPC probably the first quarter of next year, Tom. So in addition, we made a commitment as executive directors that, frankly, Trav, as issues surrounding potential litigation and also potential legislation, I think, are the two areas that we agreed that if there's any issue that potentially would impact the other agencies, ongoing or potential litigation or any legislation, that that'll get raised amongst the executive directors to ensure that, you know, these kinds of hiccups don't occur in the future.
Okay, thank you. Yes, John.
I was just going to say, I think what this whole issue underscored was the importance of having earlier consultation discussion between the executive directors or through the boards, through the JPC, on these types of issues. I know each of the regional agencies has its own often very specific and important and meaningful goals. Sometimes there's a tension between the goal of one agency and how it may conflict with another, and that the process is before each take action, and you know, this applies all the way around, to ensure that there's some really good open communication between the executive directors, and if there's any doubt that these are the types of issues that should be brought here earlier before the issue really came to a head.
Okay, thank you for those comments. Anyone else wish to comment? Okay. I think the process is good, and we're pleased that we were able to have the discussion at the executive committee, and that we have a strategy moving forward. This is we now have a quorum, so we do have a quorum. I just want to announce that. I'm not going to call the roll. Is anyone in the public? This is a public meeting. Anyone in the public wish to comment on this item? Item number 5, which is the briefing on the collaborative. Sir, come forward.
Thank you. My name is Evan Reeves with the Center for Creative Land Recycling. Just have a quick question on the collaborative process for developing this new set of guidelines. Jack, I believe you said there was going to be a collaborative process. I'm just wondering if the intent is to also include members of the affordable housing development community to make sure that the guidelines are crafted in such a way that they are implementable. Mm-hmm. Without causing unintended consequences.
Thank you, Tom. It's a very good point. I think our initial plan is to at least have the four agency planning staff meet, and then we're going to, through that effort, hopefully get agreement and concurrence, and we'll establish also then a process where we can then go out and invite folks to then participate with us. But we just wanted to meet internally first, and then we'll establish a process that will then take it to the public and on the road and invite you to participate with us.
Rich Hedges, I would encourage you, especially in areas that are near freeways that are prime for transit development, to set a fund up, especially for nonprofit below market rate housing, to do testing rather than modeling. Because we all know that you get out of a model sometimes the feelings of the people that set up the model, because garbage in can be garbage out, to quote an old phrase. So denying necessary development because of modeling is not acceptable in my book. And so we have to be very careful with this. And if there is some real doubt about the health safety, and so far from figures I've seen, there's really no more asthma cases in the county I live in, with the health departments showing it near freeways as away from freeways. So rather than jeopardize what we've been working on for years, we really need to be very clear on how we restrict development. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. So on that point, Jack, have we considered actually going in and testing some of the areas that have been developed in the past that are, like I know in my community, we have a huge development right on University mm-hmm. Avenue, right by the railroad track.
Well, Tom, coincidentally enough, the federal government is actually requiring now air pollution organizations like the Air District to put in monitors in and around the freeways. So they call it, we're referring to this as our near roadway monitoring okay. network. And that's because the growing body of epidemiological information indicates that there are health impacts living up next to a freeway, particularly one like the 80 freeway that traverses Berkeley. So this is coming. This is an issue that, frankly, that across the country everybody's dealing with. And I think we're at the forefront of this with the JPC and these guidelines that we're talking about. And I think it'll actually help, I think, for the future on what we're hoping we can do is put the tools in place for folks to deal with this issue as more and more information comes our way.
Okay, thank you very much. So we're going to go back to the item number two then on our agenda, which is the approval of the Joint Policy Committee meeting minutes of September 21st. I'd look for a motion.
So, second.
Moved and seconded. Seconded by Wagnick. Seconded by Joya.
Someone made a motion. I heard somebody make
Excuse
a motion.
Me?
Who made Brad
did. No, Wagnick. Okay. So is there any objection to us all being voted aye? Seeing none, that's the order then. Okay, the next thing is to approval of the JPC meetings for 2013. We have a list of those meetings that are in the back. It's basically we just need to make sure we get it on our calendars. And so I'd entertain a motion to adopt that schedule. Is there a motion? I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Moved by Dodge, seconded by Ross. Okay, is that objection? There's an objection. Seeing none, so we go to aye on that. The next item is the election of officers. It's a two-year term. I believe that we had an expression of interest on the behalf of Supervisor Joya to be the chair, and I understand that Adrian Tissier is interested in possibly remaining as the vice chair. So,
Mr. Chairman, I would be honored to nominate Supervisor Joya to serve as chair of the Joint Policy Committee. It's just one more step forward for his desire to be king of the world.
Yeah, I was going to second it, but I'll second it anyway.
And that includes the vice chair.
I think we'll have to roll call vote on this. No, not really. Okay, so is there any other nominations? Seeing none? Okay, then without objection, Mr. Joy, congratulations. I know you have small shoes to fill. Here, it won't be no problem for you.
I will try not to run the meetings like the Berkeley City Council meetings that you run.
Well, they're very well run. You'd be well versed to do that. Yeah. Okay, is there a nomination for vice chair?
I would nominate, Mr. Chairman, current vice chair Adrian Tissier to take up the next term.
Okay.
Second.
All right, thank you. So, is there any other nominations? Seeing none. Okay, it'll be unanimous that Adrian, and congratulations. Continue your great work. Thank you. Okay, so that concludes our action. So now we're going to go to another information item, which is the status of the Bay Area Climate and Energy Resilience Project, and Bruce Reardon is going to present this.
Good morning to you. Before I do the update, you'll see on the screen a screenshot from the new Joint Policy Committee website. So Trav and I have been working with ABAG staff to put this together. We think it's more attractive and has a lot more information at your fingertips now. It's up and running as of a couple of days ago, and we can see you get all the information on meeting packets, on presentations that are made at meetings, like this one after the meeting is over, list of the members, and then some basic information about each of the projects that we have going.
And it has a picture of the bay, which we can't figure out where it is.
It's Emeryville. Huh? Is it Emeryville?
Yeah, that's one of the guesses.
So anyway, welcome to our new Joint Policy Committee website. And we thank ABAG again for putting that up and working with us to make it go forward. So a quick update on our Climate and Energy Resilience Project. We are working on the Kresge Foundation grant. This is a six-month grant that runs through the end of February. And we're hard at work. That's basically the update. We're working on the story and the briefing paper. We're taking a series of science reports on impacts on the Bay Area and on Northern California and boiling them down to what's going to be a briefing paper, a story that we can use with a variety of players in the region. So we're hard at work now taking many reports and turning it into something that will be more usable and more user-friendly for all of us to understand what are the most important impacts for the Bay Area now and moving ahead, and also what are the success stories. We're doing interviews with a series of stakeholders in the region and getting some good success stories of things we've done already that we can point to as good examples of the kinds of things that we're going to have to do more of in the future in terms of a climate adaptation. So we'll have something for you to look at your January meeting on that. some initial work. We're doing stakeholder meetings, as I said, and a lot of this is around finding out from water agencies, cities and counties, other public health departments. We're setting up a whole set of meetings to find out more specifically what are their needs around climate adaptation, how can we help them to move forward. Since all climate adaptation in the end is local, the whole point of our project is to see as a regional 9-county kind of umbrella project, how can we provide services and products to local stakeholders, local agencies, so that they can move forward on climate adaptation in a more efficient way. So we're doing a series of stakeholder meetings, and again in January we can report back on some of the findings from that. And then we have four groups working on special work plans or roadmaps around four key issues, one on a more coordinated research system for us in the region and working with our state counterparts on climate research, a second on decision-making and governance on issues that we are going to be facing around decision-making and governance in the region around climate adaptation, a third on social equity issues and how to integrate environmental justice and social equity issues into our planning processes, or many different processes on climate adaptation, and finally a fourth kind of deep dive on what are the strategies in the region that will get us both GHG reduction, greenhouse gas emissions reduction, and help us with adaptation and building a more resilient future. An example there is urban heat island work, that it can help us to both reduce energy use, which is reducing GHGs, and improve health by lowering temperatures in urban areas, a whole set of things that we can do there. So things that can make us stronger in the near term and build towards reducing GHGs in the long term. The product of all of this in February will be a set of findings, a clearer picture really for where we are in the region in terms of the key projects and key players in terms of climate adaptation, and then a series of recommendations that will come back to you and to funders, including Kresge, as to how we move forward, how we would recommend we move forward on climate adaptation as a region over the next few years. A couple of news items. The first, as you probably saw in the papers, we had our first auction for the California Cap and Trade GHG program on Wednesday, and the results of that auction, how many allowances were sold and at what price, will be out publicly on Monday. This is a big deal. This is not primarily about adaptation, which is what our project right now is focusing on, but I thought we ought to take a couple minutes, and then I have a two-page fact sheet to give you on this. This is a major, major deal for California. We passed AB 32 in 2006 and SB 375 subsequently to that. But this is the third really big piece that we're moving forward, and eyes are on us worldwide. This is the second cap-and-trade, major cap-and-trade system on greenhouse gases in the world, the European market being the first, and we think ours is going to be a lot better. We've learned a lot from their mistakes. Why are we doing this in California when the country isn't doing it? Well, one good reason is we are the eighth largest economy in the world, and we, California, are the 12th largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. So the leadership is there. The program took 6 years to put together and to get up and running, and as of Wednesday now, up and running. So it's a very complex system, but basically what you have are about 350 businesses, large businesses, about 600 facilities in the state, that because of their size and because of the size of their greenhouse gas emissions, are required now to be a part of the cap-and-trade system. And they have to buy allowances for each ton of greenhouse gases that they emit each year. The soft landing for this is that most of those allowances were given to the businesses to start the program, and over time they will have to buy them as we move forward with the program. And what you do is each year you ratchet down the number of allowances, the number of permits, really, to emit CO2 that are out there on these businesses. so that each year, and it's about a 2% drop the first year and then 3% in years after that through 2020, we will be ratcheting down the total amount of emissions for this group of businesses and the amount that each can emit. It's done in a three-year period, but think of it as over the years between now and 2020, they have to gradually ratchet down. And they can ratchet down their emissions in two ways. They can cut their emissions by becoming more efficient or in various ways, or they can buy allowances that are on the market and do it and buy their way out of it in that sense. But there'll be a limited number of allowances. So it's a very interesting market-based system. It's opposed to doing a carbon tax. There are pros and cons of both systems. The revenue from this is going to be considerable. And in the first year, and you'll see on Monday what they got, they were expecting maybe half a billion to a billion. But we're talking billions in once the program gets totally up and running in the next 5 years. For now, just 350 businesses, large ones, are in it. But in 2013, it will include the electric utilities. In 2015, transportation fuels will go in. So the program gets a little larger as we go. And the revenues from this are going to be then used to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in other ways within our state. There may be an opportunity for those of us who are working on climate adaptation to get in on some of the revenue. But it's by law going to be about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and that's what the revenue needs to be used for, the revenue gained from selling, the state selling the allowances, auctioning them. If we can find projects that reduce greenhouse gas emissions and help us with climate adaptation, those would be possibly considered for funding. So there's going to be a lot about this over the next or the coming years, a lot, because there's a lot of money involved here, and because this is one of the ways now in AB 32 that we're going to be reducing our emissions in the state. Remember, AB 32 calls us to reduce California's emissions to 1990 levels by 2020, and to get us on the path towards the real goal, which is by 2050, that we're 80% reduction. The 2020 target is just a political target. There's no real science behind it. It was to get us going. So we've got a number of things already on the books, and SB 375 is one of them, to help us reduce emissions by 2020 and then further on. This is another part of that plan moving forward. And I have I'll pass out when I'm done here a little fact sheet and a couple of news articles that, if you want to look at them and Google them later, helpful news articles that explain the program. The other news item is rather obvious here. A couple of things about the storm that hit New York and New Jersey a couple weeks back. You'll see the map on the left is the map of Lower Manhattan from 1776, and the map on the right is the current version of Lower Manhattan, and the color coding is by evacuation zones for flooding. So the red areas are the areas that flood first and will be and are evacuated first. The kind of gold area is second, and then the yellow area would be third in the middle. And if you, I know it's hard to see from there, but the borders of 1776 Lower Manhattan, Greenwich Street on the west here, on the Hudson, and Pearl Street on the East River, are basically together with the edge of the red areas here in the current flood zones and the current evacuation. So no big surprise here, as we've seen in our maps in the Bay Area. Places that were filled over, in this case, over 200 years, are the first places to flood. And you can see the historic shoreline of Manhattan in the gold and the yellow areas, with the red being filled areas since then. There are a number of really interesting discussions that are taking place now in New York and elsewhere about what to do. Because this is, while this was the biggest version of this to happen to New York, it is not the first. And they've got a stack of reports this high talking about what could happen, what did happen now with Superstorm Sandy. They've known about the flood risks to the subways, to the electrical grid, to housing for quite a while. And if you want to Google this one, it's a very interesting article looking at three more creative ways to think about the future. And in this one, this was one of the three in the article. This was a New York Times article, I think on November 3rd. But if you just Google protecting the city before next time, this one, which they explain in the article, is using a lot of nature-based solutions, creating wetlands, creating nature-based barriers, basically, around lower Manhattan, so that you slow down the storm surge and you reduce the amount of damage that you would have from a similar storm in the future. And there are a number of things in the article about other approaches of kind of natural and recycled material really being used to, again, create a series of barrier islands, the kinds of things that we've had. There were barrier islands earlier, hundreds of years ago, putting back in place some of the natural barriers that we had that will help protect our infrastructure. One thing about New York before I leave this picture, there were a lot of terrible stories. There were also some humorous ones that came out of what happened there. One was with bird watchers. I don't know if any of you saw this, but as soon as the storm passed, the bird watchers in Manhattan were out because the storm had brought birds that they've never seen in their lifetimes from the south, and had it blown back birds that they know had migrated already and had brought them back hundreds of miles from now. So, you know, this was a huge system. Just one note here. We're not talking about climate change causing A to B a major storm. We're talking about climate change contributing to the factors that go into creating these kinds of storms. And it's a little discouraging to see people making such a distinction between the two, because we do this all the time in real life. We deal all the time in systems and in systemic causation, and don't think twice about it. An example would be smoking and cancer. We say that smoking causes lung cancer, but you can smoke and not get lung cancer. It's not A to B completely, 100% of the time. But it certainly, we know from the science, it contributes very heavily to lung cancer. I came within about this far being hit by a driver today walking down to BART. She was on her cell phone and looking at her cell phone and not at me, and I jumped out of the way. Being on a cell phone doesn't mean you're going to run somebody over, but it certainly increases the odds that that's going to happen. And that's what we're talking about here. And I hope that we can do that as we move into the next couple of years with climate adaptation and talking about the kinds of impacts that are coming, that we understand that contributing is an important thing, and that the kinds of things with warmer water, stronger winds, the kinds of things we're seeing in global warming are contributing and can contribute to increasing the odds here of these things happening.
Mark, did you want to add something? Have you finished, Bruce? I'm sorry.
Just finishing up. So a couple of things that will link us to other agenda items today between climate change and the economic development that we're going to be talking about. First, you're going to be seeing a lot more of this. This was out of the Milwaukee paper that I clipped this week. So here's a business development group in the Milwaukee area starting to sell themselves as a place where they're not going to have as many business interruptions due to tornadoes and hurricanes and other things. And they're actually selling, we can all chuckle because we love being on the West Coast, but they're selling that the upper Midwest is going to be the best place to be. Now, it's somewhat humorous, but it's the future. This is going to be a way that we sell ourselves as a region and other regions sell themselves. This is going to be a factor in determining where people want to live, where businesses want to locate. When the power goes off once because you have a major storm in New York, people will deal. When it happens a second time or a third time, people are already starting to talk about, do I really want to have my business here where it's that interrupted that many times? And the final one then is from Sean's report, which he's going to report on later. When they talk to CEOs about the main reasons why companies that originally located in the Bay Area, the reason most often given, 59% was the biggest answer, was that the founders lived here. And they live here for a variety of reasons, but place is important to people, and it's therefore important to where they're going to put their companies and where they're going to keep them. And they found the same kind of finding, and Sean can talk about this in his report, in terms of why their companies are currently here. There were, again, a number of reasons, but 45% because the owners live here. Well, why do they live here? It's not an accident. It may have been that they went to school here. It may be that venture capital was here for them. It may be a whole set of things. But we know the quality of life in the Bay Area is a very important part of why people choose to move here and choose to start companies here. And again, climate change won't be the only factor, but it's going to be one now that we have to consider as we move forward. And that is my report.
Thank you very much, Art. So Mark, and then Mary.
Thank you, Bruce. Interesting as always. This coming Monday, and I guess we can be the first to head to the public trough of the allowances that are going to be generated here. I'd like to know or wonder if there is a mechanism, you referenced it, but is there truly a mechanism by which those allowances are going to be dispersed, and who's the arbiter of that? And is there a difference, is it solely, does the legislation say it's solely for mitigation? Can it be for adaptation, a combination of both? And how? And I'd like to see us be the first to jump in and provide some type of a framework for the dispensation of those dollars. Thanks. A
couple of answers. One, by law, and this is going to be tested in court, we're sure. There's already a lawsuit over the cap and trade program that was filed Wednesday by the Chamber of Commerce, I think National Chamber, U.S. Chamber of Commerce. State? Thank you. By law, the revenues from the allowance sales have to be used to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which is the point of AB 32. So again, if we can find things that reduce greenhouse gas emissions and provide adaptation benefit, some of those may qualify. The answer to your first part of your question is that there's state legislation that's been passed on setting up categories for how the money is going to be spent, but there are a whole set of decisions to be made. I know some of our agencies have already been talking with their counterparts at the state.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the ARB is going to make those decisions, not the legislature.
It's ARB and the Department of Finance.
And the Department of Finance. So it's not in the legislature's hand unless they amend the law.
Okay, Mark, let's just put in for our allowance.
Those are my questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Does anyone in the public wish to make a comment on this presentation? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much. Let's move on now to the next item, which is going to be a briefing about the HUD-funded scope of work for the Bay Area, and Trav's going to introduce this topic.
The next three items on your agenda are all interrelated. As the Chairman mentioned, number seven is a briefing by MTC staff on the Bay Area Regional Prosperity Plan. Number eight is a briefing by Sean Randolph on the regional economic assessment that was prepared for the JPC by the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. Item 9 is an explanation on how we'll incorporate these two efforts, along with some work that ABAG is doing in our assessment on the scope of the regional economic strategy. So with that brief introduction, we can turn to Vikrant Sood of MTC staff.
Great. Thank you, Will. And good morning, and thank you very much for inviting me here to make a brief presentation about the Regional Prosperity Plan, which is funded through HUD. Sorry, we're going to try and coordinate the PowerPoint. Many of you may already know some of the information about the project, but just by way of a brief overview, the Regional Prosperity Plan in the Bay Area is being funded through a $5 million grant program from the Department of Housing and Urban Development's Sustainable Communities Partnership Project. And the goal of that project is to integrate land use, housing, economic and workforce development, and infrastructure investment in regions across the country. And the project in the Bay Area is really going to be focusing on jobs and housing development in transit-served communities as well as underserved communities through three interconnected areas of work. Bill, Bruce, if you could go to the next one. And I'll just go over these. The first is, as was highlighted in the grant application to HUD, an effort from the program to ensure that underrepresented groups have a real voice in the development and implementation of the program. And the project allocates about $760,000 in subgrants to community-based organizations and nonprofit organizations for community for capacity building as well as outreach activities over the next 2 years. The second work area is related to Housing the Workforce Initiative, which will fund resources, tools, and best practices that promote the development as well as preservation of affordable housing in transit-served areas, as well as neighborhood stabilization in communities that are at risk of displacement. And this work area also will provide more than $1 million in subgrants to pilot projects over the next 2 years. The third area, which is of interest to the meeting today, is the Economic Opportunity Work Plan that will fund the development of a regional economic development strategy that is primarily focused on the needs of low and moderate income households in the region and residents who are already here. Next. The need for developing a strategy at a regional level focused on this target population is really driven by some of the recent trends in job growth and education attainment. As you can see on the chart, this is the job growth in the region over the last few decades, and you can see that it's a fairly uneven growth at best over the last 20 years for sure. And even the numbers here are for the overall job growth. It does not break it down by income categories or the type of jobs that were created. And we know from data, again, that many of these jobs that were created in the region were not able to provide living wages to the residents or advancement opportunities. Next slide. The next chart actually provides a little more clarity on the type of jobs that were created. And you can see in the blue bars the proportion of jobs in the region that were created by income category. And the real concern, again, is that the type of jobs are gravitating, the amount of jobs are gravitating towards the opposite ends of the income spectrum. And not a lot of jobs are being created in the middle income category, which would be taken up by workers with moderate or even low skills. The same trend is reflected even in the education attainment across the region. For example, in the South Bay, there are now equal number of workers who have no college degree and the number of workers who have a master's degree. So in essence, if there are any takeaways for the HUD project, that is that the regional economy is creating new jobs, but workers who have low or moderate skills are not able to have as much access to opportunity as we would like, and also that the region is also also creating a lot of jobs that are paying lower wages, even though we live in a region that has some of the highest housing and living costs in the country. So the goal of the economic development strategy for the HUD project, at least, is to identify pathways for strengthening and expanding economic opportunities for this target group, low and moderate income households, and also to fund some of the pilot projects that will identify successful approaches that can then be replicated in other communities across the region. And all of this work is being supported by the program with more than $1.5 million in support. And just in closing, I would also just like to acknowledge some of the other work that is happening across the region that will be folded into the HUD project. And these are some of the foundational efforts. You'll hear from Sean in the next item about the work that was done by the Bay Area Council. There is also a moving to work study that is being funded through Living Cities. And ABAG and MTC are also doing jobs and housing analysis as part of the Plan Bay Area project that will all be folded into the HUD project. With that, I just wanted to also, there's a lot more information about the project, and I'm happy to provide that as a follow-up. But for now, if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
So on the actual granting of the money, can you describe how that would work and what kind of projects you're looking at? Are those construction jobs? Are those ongoing jobs? Are those What kind of jobs are we talking about?
And I think some of this will come through from the next presentation, but the real challenge has been for the regional economy to create jobs that can then be accessible to workers who have low or moderate skills. So some of that leads us, you know, and we still haven't developed the overall strategy, and that's part of the work that we have to do, look at the data analysis and the work that is happening across the region and what are the successful strategies there. But it would be a two-pronged effort, one protecting and expanding the type of jobs that can be accessible to these workers, and the other is workforce training and development that can help the low and moderate income workers, low and moderate skill workers, to access some of the moderate income jobs.
Okay, Mary, did you have a comment?
Quick question. Just a baseline for myself. I'm not quite sure what the number is you're using for income. I see percentages, particularly on slide 4, but what's the average, or what's moderate, and then I can understand what upper and extremely low are comparatively to.
Yeah, we may have to get back to you on that. So these are based on average median incomes. And so there are, you know, for example, it says extremely low, low, and they're all based on how much is the average median income in the region. So I can get back to you with
So we don't know data. What the median income is then?
We do. I just
okay,
don't have the numbers
have
right
you.
Now.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any other comments? Does anyone from the public wish to address this issue?
Just one point on what it costs to live in the Bay Area. San Mateo County, I was at a meeting last night where Samaritan House suggested, and it's not the first time I've read and heard this figure, takes an $82,000 a year salary to afford a two-bedroom apartment on the average in San Mateo County. And many of the agencies start doing assistance at, I think, around 60-some thousand. But we have officials here that could probably tell us that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So let's move right on to Sean's presentation then.
There we go. Thanks very much, Mr. Chair. I'm really very happy to be able to give you today the result of the project that you initiated much earlier this year in the spring. When you asked the Economic Institute to prepare a study and analysis on what's driving the Bay Area's economy in terms of job creation and what may be inhibiting it. You've had a couple of interim presentations over the last few months as we've worked through various stages, so this is the final product. It's on our website. I believe it's probably on your website. It's at the printer. We'll have hard copies for everybody available probably within a week or 10 days. So what I can share this morning is sort of the high-level findings. And you also asked us to not just present the data, but also some ideas about things that would be actionable by the JPC that might help the move the needle in terms of economic growth and ultimately job creation. And I think what I'll present is very consistent with what Vikram just presented, and so I think we're really very much on the same track. We see this project ramping into and supporting the HUD project, and again, the findings are going to be very consistent. So if you move to the next slide, okay, Bruce is a slide person, great. So the objective of the study, again, was to develop a shared foundation for everybody, business and government, of economic facts. Assess, again, what's driving and what's inhibiting economic growth and jobs, impediments, things that could perhaps improve it, and then broad recommendations on what might go into a regional strategy. Again, the document is not a regional strategy. That's another product, another process, but we're trying to give some directional thoughts about what might go into the strategy. And I should say before going into this, I want to thank MPC for providing resources to get the study done. One of the requirements of that was that the funds from MTC that were on behalf of the JPC be matched by the business and economic development community. And it was great to see, in fact, that they stepped up with some alacrity and actually overmatched the contribution by JPC and MTC. So I think the product is unique in that it has been completely 50-50 jointly supported by regional agencies and the business and economic development community has had a lot of input from both going forward. Next. So what I'll go through very quickly, what we're finding in the economy, a few findings about high-level strengths and weaknesses, some things we think are affecting competitiveness, which means, of course, job growth, and then some high-level recommendations. Next. Next. Okay. The first finding, something not surprising, is that per capita GDP is very, very high here. It always has been, but if you compare the top line, which is the Bay Area, with the U.S. average and with the average you would find for other major metropolitan areas in California, San Diego and Los Angeles, then in fact you can see that we are very, very high, probably the highest income levels per capita in the United States. I think Boston, Washington, D.C. would be up there in about the same category, but by any standard national or certainly California, very, very high per capita income. Next. Counterbalancing that, the less good story, you'll see on this slide there's been a divergence between population and employment. And so you can see the top line, the light dotted line, that's the population. We've been growing. You see the labor force being below that, and of course there's always a difference between the population and the labor force, but you can see where we are with employment. Those lines have been divergent. There's been a little uptick from the bottom of the recession, but you can see over time the gap has increased to be very, very wide between our employment levels and our population and our workforce. And I think that's a huge issue for this region and for LMI communities as well, because despite the wealth and success at the high end, there are enormous gaps that have been getting wider. Next. There is some good news in there. We're bouncing back and forth from good news to not so good news and back again. This looks at the forecast for job growth over a couple different periods of time. The left-hand bars are really from just before the recession out to 2020. The middle one is from 2010, basically post-recession to 2020, and then the far right is 2020 to 2040. So in the middle, what we're seeing is a lot of this job growth is going to be making up for jobs that were lost in the recession. There's a lot of ground to cover there. But the good news is that by any forecast we've developed or have seen, the outlook for job growth is stronger in the Bay Area than it is in California and than it is in the United States. And that's for some reasons that I'll get to in just a moment. Thanks. So here we are. Why is it stronger? It's because employment here tends to be concentrated compared to the rest of the state and the rest of the country in very high value-added industries. And it's what you might guess right away. It's high-tech in every sense of the word, everything that goes into that big high-tech bucket. So the big category by which it's measured in statistics is professional scientific and technical services. These are scientists, technicians, basically people with positions that you would associate with STEM occupations, science, people with science, technology, engineering, and math backgrounds. And you can see how actually our strength in this area has been growing. The top line, so the white bar is 2011, the yellow bar is 1990. We've been growing those jobs, information, you know, the whole IT industry, social media, all of that. Lots of strength in other areas, but you can really see where the growth is coming from here in the Bay Area. Next. And this really compares us to the rest of the U.S. It's the same question, but by just a different measure. And you can see the bottom line being a computer and electronic manufacturing. Our share of these jobs nationally, and this would also apply to software, it applies to scientific R&D services, computer services. These are all, for the most part, and of course, biotech and pharmaceuticals. These are all technologically based industries. For the most part, they employ people with either high levels of skill or specialized skills, And relative to the rest of the country, which is the vertical red line, we have a very, very high concentration relative to our population. Next. Technical question.
Clearly, Bruce and I aren't in that bar up at the top of skill.
Is that the right one now?
Yeah. Okay.
This one?
You're rolling. Keep going forward.
Forward.
Yeah. Next one.
Next one.
Okay. Next one. And key findings. Okay. We're back again. Thanks, Bruce. Next one. So, what are our strengths? Quality of life. Highly educated labor force, venture capital, and an innovation culture that is really unique in the U.S., unique in its intensity in the world. And I have one slide on each one of these. So, or at least some of these. So venture capital, it's a really good story for us. The industry was created here, and you can see the yellow line is California, the white line is the Bay Area, and California gets about 50 to 55% of all the venture investment nationally. The Bay Area is getting about 40 to 45% of all venture investment nationally. So we capture within 50 miles of right here the lion's share of California investment and the lion's share of national investment as well, and a very high proportion of global venture investment. Next. The innovation culture, well, there's a lot of ways to measure innovation, even how you define it. Nobody would agree on one definition, but you know, one pretty accessible measure is patents, number generated, and people worry about, well, Austin and Seattle and San Diego and Boston, and well, we should. But if you take patents as a measure of creativity, innovation, the Bay Area pretty much blows anywhere else in the country out of the water by any measure. That could be total patents. It could be patents per relative to the size of the population. National share, and on we go. So reflecting that, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office decided earlier this year they would open a new PTO office in Silicon Valley, which just reflecting the high generation rate we have here. Next. The weaknesses. Well, some of this isn't going to be a big surprise to anybody. Housing regulations and the labor force, and I think all of these go to some degree, but especially the labor force, to what Vikrant was talking about with LMI communities. Next. So nobody's going to be shocked by this. We have really, really high housing prices relative to the U.S., relative to other cities in California like San Diego and Los Angeles. In a way, that's a good thing. If we had really, really cheap housing prices, it would probably mean our people are lowly paid, and we have a slow economy. So the high prices reflect a lot of demand to be here. And that's a good thing, except it's not all demand. A lot of it is constraint on supply. And I think that is one of the major factors that explains, not the only one, but a major one, why the prices are as high as they are. And you could say, well, prices fell so much in the recession, and they have especially in the parts of the East Bay and North Bay, but the reality is even with the fall in prices, the differential in housing costs between here and the rest of the country is absolutely enormous. Next. We spent a good amount of time talking to businesses on regulatory issues. The business organizations that supported the project wanted to make sure that, you know, we talked to them, but we also did a survey. We talked about individually about 100 companies that were selected according to their counties. So we've covered all the counties, the size of the business, large, medium, small, and sectors. So it wasn't all real estate developers. We had tech people and other kinds of business people as well. And on the regulatory environment, the views were kind of mixed. It wasn't that it was great or that it was terrible. But I think the sense that we got from talking to all these companies was Not that regulation is bad or that it's just a horrible situation, not at all. I think most of them felt that, well, regulation, there's a good purpose for it, and it could actually be a very good thing from a lot of perspectives. But the concern was more with regulatory transparency and regulatory efficiency. And again, we heard about the lack of consistency between regulations at the state level, the regional level, the local level. And the concern was, as these things get layered on, many of them trying to do the same thing, each layer adds cost and time and complexity, and ultimately that affects competitiveness. So the call that we were hearing from them was, work with us to help reduce the complexity and the layering and increase the transparency of the regulatory process. Next. Labor force. This is kind of a complex one to talk about because it's one coin but two sides of it. The good news is we have the most highly educated, best compensated, and deepest pool of workers, especially in technology, but other fields too, in the country. At the same time, we heard from our surveys and interviews more and more from more and more companies that they are finding a very hard time, or an increasingly hard time, finding qualified people to fill the jobs. And people are coming from around the country to start companies here. They're coming from around the world to work here. But even with that, there are not enough people here with the qualifications and skills that companies need to fill those requirements. And there's a big gap. It's a very strange thing between a lot of job openings all around the region and a very high unemployment rate. And a lot of this is because of the lack of skills and education by a lot of people out there who could and should be employed but who aren't. A majority of the businesses we talked to said they were having a hard time meeting workforce needs. Of course, that tends not only to mean we're not addressing unemployment the way we could, but it means, well, if you need to find workers, you can go anywhere in the world. There's a lot of reasons why companies are here, but it does increase the pressure to move things off to where you can find the people who can do the job if you really had to do that. And this is especially true, of course, for technology firms. Next. Further findings, that this is one economic region, that what really drives growth is business starts rather than business moves, and there's a few challenges. So next. So the theme of this is one region. What you see here is just numbers that show that there is an enormous cross-county commute in the Bay Area. It's more pronounced for some counties than others. Contra Costa is in the report itself. We draw some numbers for Contra Costa, draw numbers for San Francisco, where, of course, a lot of people come in and out. But, you know, the bottom line is that a majority of people are crossing county lines. And it may be because they choose to live in one area, or maybe they have to live in one area because that's where they can afford to live. The jobs are wherever the jobs are. But this question, it is one workforce for the region. It's not a compartmentalized county workforce, and we really need to be focused on that fact. It's one economy, and people are moving throughout the region, and so the transportation, the mobility that allows access to those jobs is very, very important. Next. Also, the region, we talk about tech and startups, and people think, oh, well, it's Silicon Valley. Well, it was Silicon Valley in 1991. The depth or intensity of the green, it shows where the startups are in tech companies. And, of course, you see San Francisco and a few other places, but you're really concentrated San Jose and Silicon Valley. But at the next slide, if you pop that out, well, there we are. We're 2007, and see how the green is spread. Of course, it is still most concentrated in the far South Bay, but you see large concentrations of new startups virtually everywhere in this region. So when we talk about tech and tech jobs and tech opportunities, it's a regional phenomenon. It's a regional opportunity. And why do we think this is so important? And I'll mention this one more time in a second because it is important. Think about economic development strategy. You look at the job multipliers from tech. In other words, the jobs that are supported by one person in tech, we found, we're still tweaking the number, but it's about 3.5 to 1, 3.6. That means for every tech job, that person ends up supporting 3.5 or 6 other jobs in the region. In manufacturing, it's 1.5. And so the spread of tech throughout the Bay Area is a good thing, because actually that's a tremendous stimulus to job growth across the economic spectrum, including LMI communities. Next. You've seen this before, but it's it's still very important. A lot of economic development strategy tends to focus on competing to encourage companies to move in from somewhere, from another county, from another state. It could be anywhere. The reality is, and that can be very important, of course, but the reality is, for job creation, most new jobs don't come from companies moving in from some other place. And in fact, when we talk about losing jobs, most jobs aren't lost because companies leave. They do leave. You don't want them to. You got to try to keep them. But in the end of the day, the impact on employment is is pretty low. And this includes, you know, companies who are hiring elsewhere that could have hired here but are not moving their headquarters. They're staying here. Where the lion's share of job creation comes from and job loss is on the creation side, new companies. Entrepreneurs starting companies, those companies grow. We know that that they account for a huge share of job creation in their first 1, 2, 3 years. Then there tends to be a big die-off because, of course, they don't all make it. And the big piece of job destruction is companies failing. Mostly new and young companies. The big employers, HP and others, they actually don't move the needle that much in terms of creation, but it's these younger companies. And so that would suggest, I mean, we think that if you really focusing economic development strategy should be looking at, of course, everybody's always going to compete to get companies to move in, but that's not going to have a huge impact for the most part. It's the key thing is really focusing on small companies, making an environment where they're more likely to succeed and survive. Next. Okay, another big change, population. You can see the big dip, 35 to 54. That basically says that as we are aging here, as other places are, there's going to be fewer people in that prime earning range, more people who are relatively older. As people retire, as they are starting to do now, that's going to create a lot of job opportunities for people to move into those jobs being vacated, but they've got to have the right skills. The people retiring are pretty highly educated. We've got to have equally educated, if not more educated, people to replace them. We don't. And then it has implications for housing, because maybe there's going to be a need for less single-family housing in the next 20 years or so, or 30 years, and more need for multi-unit housing in places where, you know, people who are relatively older might come back in the city and live. So it does have implications for housing. Next. So here we are, same thing. Baby boomers retiring, big challenge, an opportunity to fill those slots. We compete for business, but we also compete not just through policy, but by having an attractive place to live. And I think the fact that when we ask companies, as Bruce pointed out, why is your company here? Overwhelmingly, the biggest answer has been the founder started the company here, or the founder lives here. So there's a huge factor there where making this an attractive place for people to want to live and come and start companies and grow companies, it's extremely important. If we're an attractive place, it gives us a huge advantage over other places, but it means a healthy environment. We're not being flooded by sea level rise. We've got decent commutes and a healthy environment. Next. One or two more slides. That's next. Factors that are supporting competitiveness in anywhere. This is anywhere in the world. Access to markets. Can you sell your stuff? Do you have a big market? Access to factors of production, labor, workforce, capital. Can you get finance? Cost of doing business. This is really regulation to a large degree, but also housing cost. Sector strength, like we have in tech. Quality of life, that CEO-founder effect. And basically, we're doing pretty well in 1, 4, and 5. We got a huge market. We got great global connections and infrastructure for connecting to Asia and other markets. We have, as I mentioned before, these unique, really tech strengths, and we got a great quality of life under pressure, but that makes people want to found companies here. The weaker points are the labor and the capital. The capital is okay on the venture capital side, but it's really hard for small companies to get debt finance, especially since the recession. And the labor, as I said, is two-edged sword. We got an amazing labor pool, but we got a big challenge having trained, educated people coming up through our educational system who actually can fill the jobs. And having that labor gap is not a good thing. Next, recommendations. Here's the bottom line. Think about economic strategy going forward. We think there's a value in identifying a public-private focal point for regional economic strategy. We're being kind of careful about the phrase focal point because we don't know what it should be. But if it's the JPC, then we're hearing from business, it would be very good to have a business advisory committee for the JPC so that the economic viewpoint and economic impacts of different options is brought forward to the beginning of the planning process and not tacked on the end. You know, we've seen with various agencies in the last couple of years how letting the economy discussion slide to the end can cause all kinds of problems. Much better to have it hardwired into the front end, and then the business community is with you. Another option would be to sort of engage a third-party partner to be a convener on behalf of JPC and to sort of help bring the business community and JPC and agency members to the table and carry that analysis further. But that there should be a focal point, and we don't have a focal point today, really. I already mentioned engaging businesses earlier. The other thing that came up that government could do is harmonizing local regulations at a regional level. We heard many times that there are similar permitting requirements in different cities and counties, and it really adds cost if you're doing business on a regional level, that to the extent you could harmonize those, it would make a big difference. I think JPC heard a couple of years ago, actually, from people in the solar industry saying, well, for solar installers, you got a different set of requirements for every city. It makes it hard to scale. It adds cost. If you had a harmonized regulation region-wide, actually, it would drop the cost of solar installation a lot, and it would help reach our greenhouse gas goals more quickly. Next. Final thing, economic development strategy. We think it's most effective to focus strategy, not exclusively, but primarily on areas where we have economic strength. And that's where I mentioned those industries that are the technology industries that, you know, define us relative to the rest of the world. I mentioned that job multiplier, 3.5:1, much better than any other industry, including anything in manufacturing. And that could be a major factor in bringing up the LMI community because those people go out, and you could say it's trickle-down, but I think it's more cascade-down here, that, you know, they are hiring lawyers and accountants, they are buying things in retail stores, they're going to restaurants and bars and doing all those things. So it's a big multiplier for those industries. And then the last thing, which I think really taps into what Vikrant is talking about, the key thing for any region being competitive is the workforce. It's the quality of the workforce, the availability of the workforce. We have this huge demand for qualified people. There's a much too high unemployment rate. There's a skills and training gap. It's only going to get bigger. And so the focus on education, K through 12, obviously, but up through higher ed and the community colleges, especially in workforce development and training, if we can get a better bead on a regional strategy and a region-wide focus on workforce development and training and really make a strong effort in that, I think that can make a big difference as well. And I think that is the last slide. There's the site. I want to thank everybody at the JPC and MTC and our business supporters for giving us the opportunity to produce this report.
Great. Thank you very much, Sean. Appreciate the report. Supervisor Joya, did you want to be recognized?
Yeah. Sean, on that slide, and I've seen you present that number before about the percent of business, the sort of the percent of businesses coming in, startups moving out. We hear so often about, well, people, businesses move out of the Bay Area because of regulations. And what this chart would seem to show is that that's not entirely true. I mean, I think that's really useful, and I'm not saying, I mean, as you point out in another chart, that regulations often are inconsistent and become barriers. Maybe they become barriers to growth. Like that. But they're not necessarily responsible for businesses moving out. So I think that's interesting, sort of understanding that. But is that based upon number of establishments? So how does that relate to jobs? In other words, you may have a bunch of large establishments moving out versus small. So it doesn't give a breakdown of how you look at that by jobs. It's number of establishments. Right, it's a difference if those are very small establishments versus very large establishments, right? Because that gives you a truer picture of what that impact is of all of these. I mean, new establishments, the birth, expansion, moving in, moving out, death. Is there a way to get this chart in terms of jobs?
You mean well, small here, business, big
well,
business?
Yeah, in other words, this says business starts. So if you say is this adjusted for jobs by business or number of actual establishments?
No,
there's a distinction.
It's the jobs. So
okay.
The top line is job creation and job destruction. So what it would say is say they're just
got it.
The
okay.
Right.
So this is unclear because you say establishments moving out. So that's the job. So this is truly based on jobs. So that sort of confirms that point that really it is about the new establishments. I guess the one thing you wouldn't know is how many additional new establishments you would bring in if you had a better environment, possibly, more reasonable housing, for example, different types of regulations that could result potentially in a greater number of birth of new establishments or preventing establishments from going out of business.
Yeah, it could, and I think on the regulatory question, it's a little bit murky to say exactly what the impact is. It doesn't look that primarily companies leave because of regulation.
Right.
I think regulation is, for many, it's more additive. You know,
right.
You have a cost structure, and regulation is another cost element on top of existing
right.
impediments, and which could be educational levels or whatever. And so it's an additional increment that piles up on the negative side, or can. I think for some companies, some companies may be affected by some regulations more than others. So I think things like CEQA.
Right.
If you need to build a facility and it's going to take it 3 years
right.
instead of 1 year, well, those companies, they may well decide they're going to do it somewhere else. So I think it depends.
So they may not move out, but they build a facility somewhere else. So this doesn't capture that necessarily.
It doesn't capture that, no.
Right, right. Thanks.
Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, if for some reason in my packet I didn't get a copy of this report. Is it available back here somewhere?
It will be.
Right? Hopefully. Okay. It's a both reports have been tremendous. And Vikrut, the answer to my question, Steve mentioned it, is on page 2 of your report, was $82,500 was the Bay Area median household income. So we got that question answered. Thank you, Steve. And lastly, it's really interesting that we're talking about the lack of a trained workforce. We have many fabulous educational facilities within the Bay Area, from Stanford to Cal and Go Bears, but universities to community colleges to the K-12 system, that there's this breakdown between the workforce and the system that's here to support it. So somehow we do need to look into that and find out what that link is, because that's stunning, frankly, that we're having that economic impact, yet the education system, I think, in the Bay Area is one of the best in the world, I dare say.
I think part of the answer to that, again, it's a big complex topic, is that we have at the higher ed level, the higher education level, the better we are. UC is fantastic. But PPIC has done some work that says, looking ahead, that the system as it is now cannot produce or will not produce enough trained people for the job requirements in the future, and just our own university system in California. If you look then at the effects of the various kinds of budget cutbacks across the board at community colleges through UC, that's not helping, that's hurting, and then you have the fact that a lot of people, again, thinking about not just, you know, the PhD types, but people with technical skills, technical training, technicians, coming up from K through 12, an awful lot need remedial education just to function in a Cal State University. The community colleges are under a lot of pressure. Businesses use them a lot for, you know, specialized kind of training and retraining. So I think what's happened to state education on the whole has not been helpful for this. And then a lot is about very specialized skills where people need to be constantly being retrained and brought up in the system. And as you're saying, we don't have the kind of connection we could or should between those industries and workforce development entities. On an individual basis, some community colleges have terrific relations with industries in their communities, but region-wide, system-wise, we don't have it today.
And those are really good points. And another missing element may be that the workforce, the businesses are evolving, and yet the universities and the education system isn't evolving to those trends of what they're looking for, the training in those particular categories maybe. So hopefully we can be a catalyst to bridging those gaps.
Okay, I have Mark Green, then Zach, then Mark Ross.
Sean, a couple of things. One, on your early thoughts on the focal point, which I know you said you don't have it precisely, but I'm sure you've given some thought to it. And then secondly, you know, I've been one here, I think Tom has also, to some extent, about the idea of having actually the business community involved earlier, being an auxiliary group to the JPC. And on that point, what an ideas of composition, amount, business segments, et cetera, what your thoughts are early on that also.
On the focal point, you know, our initial thought is the right agencies are here. So if there were to be a place where government thinking comes together with the right kind of interest and focus and authority, it could be the JPC, in which case it's a pretty convenient place for the business and economic development community to plug in. The alternative, which is in the written version of the report, is, and I'm not trying to make the case for the Institute to do anything particular, but you know, if there was more work to be done on an economic strategy per se, and then this document isn't an economic strategy, or you wanted to have convening with businesses around how do you develop a strategy, you know, we would be happy, or I'm sure other people like us would be happy to play that kind of a role. So there's sort of a couple of different ways to do it. In-house, partner externally to get that kind of activity underway. The composition on the business side, you know, we talked about it a little bit earlier this year and last year here. I think that should be a discussion of the JPC members with members of the business and economic development community. I would imagine it could include, there's only about a half a dozen, the principal economic development and business organizations in the region, and then you might want to get some actual business people, I mean not organizational people, but some CEOs or entrepreneurs to be part of this as well, get their direct input. It's hard to get their time and attention. Entrepreneurs are just working to stay alive. But I would imagine some combination of the major business groups where an economic development groups, where, and that's what they do. It's their job to focus on economic development. So they've often put more thought into it and have the time to put more thought into it than a lot of individual businesses. But it gets some mix of businesses in there, too. So you're hearing straight from them what they think and what they experience. I guess lastly, on the getting economic views into the conversations earlier, no, I've kind of witnessed this challenge for years now through lots of hearings, you know, here in BCDC and elsewhere, where you'll be pretty far down the road in developing a plan, and somewhere at the very end we'll say, oh, what about the economy? And then it's sort of, oh, let's tack on something about the economy, but it's so late that and the business groups often, they come into it late because they're not always thinking about regulation and plans, and when they do, there's already a dislocation. So we think it would be in everybody's interest to try to avoid those dislocations, and just by beginning the conversation earlier, where often having somebody stand up and testify for 3 minutes at a hearing, it's not really a discussion or a deep dialogue. I think it needs to go beyond that. It's something a bit more deeper in structure where both sides are really, you know, trading thoughts about how to go forward together. And just one example, I don't know if this is really an example, but I was reading a couple weeks ago documents, you know, through BCDC on the planning underway at JPC for the adaptation plan. Big deal, and long-term plan. And the document was, you know, quite long. There's a lot of detail. And reading through it, I didn't find one reference to the economy or the business community or economic development. There was one reference to consulting or engaging the general public, and there was one reference to, you know, the talk about retreat from the Bay Side, you know, could be sensitive with some businesses. But, you know, BCDC went through, you know, a year and a half of really hard work to get the Bay Plan done, I think in part because it didn't bring that economic perspective forward early enough. The Air District has had its own issues. I think to the extent that in things like the adaptation plan, and this could apply to any other plans, SES, of course, if you can bring that discussion forward rather than let it drift to the end of the conversation, I think a lot of dislocation can be avoided and you get to a better result more quickly.
So I'm getting a little conscious of time. We have a couple more items on the agenda, but let me just mention that this issue of creating a business advisory committee, I would like to refer that actually to our executive committee to have them consider that and figure out how we want to move forward on that. So rather than trying to resolve it here today, we can move forward with that and hopefully have some report. Zach?
My comments are thanks, Chair.
Tom?
Mark?
I was just
going to hear
the same numbers.
Okay, Brad?
Mark does that to me every time. Just a quick comment. The genes process that we were talking about earlier is going to be a good indicator of how we're able to work with the business community, because that if that process comes up with something that has gone sideways with the business community this time again, and we haven't come up with a good way for them to work, then we're going to have, you know, we've just recreated another problem that we have to deal with again. So,
the Contra Costa trio.
Just a quick input on the executive committee to consider the East Bay Economic Development Alliance as a partner in the discussion. Very heavily supported by Alameda County and Contra Costa County, a regional effort, and I would like to see them at the table.
Well, I think that obviously when the executive committee gets to look at that, they need to be there.
I think it would be useful just to get a clear sentiment here today if there's agreement on this idea on the business advisory, so that then the details are discussed at the executive, not the proposal. But I think just making clear that there's clear direction here, and for one, I think it's a good idea. So it may be useful just to make sure that there's a consensus among JPC here today before executive committee even takes it up.
Sure. I sort of assumed there was. Is there anybody who doesn't think this is a proper course to be taking? Zach, do you want to?
No, I think it's absolutely a proper course. My only comment would be I think we need to take a close look at the existing organizations, very much including the Institute, before we set our minds on creating something new. And I think that's consistent with what everybody said.
Right. I think that's right. So having that in mind, okay, thank you. We're going to, Trav's going to now make a presentation to us about the regional economy. Oh, sure. Well, I was actually going to make the comments at the end of all of this. Your mind will take, because they're sort of related, and then we'll come back. Okay, definitely. Okay.
On item number 9, we provided you with a brief memorandum that was prepared by ABAG staff to give you an overview of the information that you've just received in the last two briefings, along with a summary of the policy background report that ABAG staff is preparing, which will be incorporated into the sustainable community strategy. Now, as you may recall, back in July, you unanimously adopted a motion directing Bruce and me, along with the agency staff, to work with the business community in drafting an action plan that assesses what elements should be included in a regional economic development strategy, the likely costs of developing such a strategy, and the potential sources of funding for such work. You decided to use the regional economic assessment that you were just briefed on as the foundation for our analysis, which you want to be aimed at determining the scope, the content, the cost, and the possible sources of funding for a regional economic development strategy. To carry out this direction, Bruce and I, along with the agency staff, will be meeting with the Bay Area Business Coalition, which includes all of the organizations that are working on business development in the Bay Area. We'll be doing that on December 3rd. We're also following up on a suggestion made at your last meeting when Senator Mark DeSaulnier recommended that we should meet with the Bay Area Legislative Caucus, which he co-chairs with Assemblyman Rich Gordon. The purpose of these meetings will be to get the input from the business community and the Legislative Caucus on the scope of the elements that should be included in a regional economic development strategy. The Bay Area Council Economic Institute has already provided its recommendations as to what should be in the scope in its final report to you. We'll then compare what everybody wants to have included in a strategy with the work that's underway at MTC and ABAG to determine if there's anything left undone. If there is, we'll use this void to define the tasks, the budget, the funding for these efforts. You can then decide whether it's appropriate for the JPC to undertake this work. And as indicated in our memo, this work plan that I've just outlined was endorsed by your executive committee at its meeting last week. So we provided this as an information item for you. If you want to take action to endorse it or change it, you can do so. But we do not need action.
Okay. Does anyone wish to make any comments about that report? David. Seeing none, we'll hear from the public. Public, you want to speak on either this last item or this item? Please come forward.
Yes, I'm the public. Paul Campos with the Building Industry Association. And I wanted to elaborate and reinforce a point that Sean made about the manner of engaging with the business community, but not just the business community, but all the stakeholders in the Bay Area. And I think, Sean, your point is spot on about the inadequacy of the three-minute testimony, hearing from me or a lineup of people just for 3 minutes, and that's the first time you're hearing our views as the actual decision makers, where, you know, we may have spent 10 hours with agency staff, but really that is important and necessary, but it's not sufficient. And I think that getting the business organizations and all stakeholders to have lengthy opportunities to interact with you folks, the principals, as I call them, on the agencies, both the JPC and its constituent agencies, is really important. One of the most, I thought, productive and helpful public process mechanisms that I've seen in many years was actually during the BCDC Bay Plan Amendment process, where we had all the commissioners in this room and we had six or seven panelists representing different interests, and we're able to engage in an actual thoughtful dialogue between panelists and members for several hours. And I thought that advanced each side's understanding and allowed for a level of understanding of the BCDC commissioners of the different perspectives that just getting staff reports or getting letters or emails from the organizations outside of the process would not provide. So I really want to stress the importance of that concept and hope that we can expand on those kinds of interactions in the future. Thanks.
Excellent point. Okay, anybody else?
This has been a great meeting. Thank you, Mr. Randolph. I really appreciated your report. I thought it was very good. And I would just like to emphasize, I'm on a board that regulates 550,000 individuals and businesses in the state of California. And I find that our employers are very pro-regulation generally. And what you said about transparency and efficiency is one of the most important things they ask for. And I would agree with you 100%. And when it comes to any of the development we're trying to do, there has to be ways to make it easier for the building trades to educate people to come into the workforce, because this is going to dovetail into what I want to talk to about education. And this is just not an old guy saying, in my day we did it this way. But when I was in high school, we had a two-track system. I left that high school with the ability to either go to college or go into the building trades. I could tear an engine down. I had 4 hours of auto mechanics for 2 years. I could read blueprints, and I also could read and write. And I worked in the trades for years and then went on to college. I now have a master's degree, part of it in urban planning. So we need to get back to a system, and it's expensive, that prepares young people not for a trade school, but for actually going to work when they get out of high school. And if you want to talk about something that's inhibiting our economy, it's especially in manufacturing, it's finding skilled people, especially machinists. There's been tremendous amount of reports around the country, as well as the Bay Area. 60 Minutes just did a piece on it. We have to get back to some fundamental educations and realize that everybody's not going to college. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. So I might mention, I think that this is actually true. I think that we really do need to do more in terms of the educational system. It's pretty clear. We'll have to figure out how we can do that. I'm very proud of the fact that in our area, Peralta Community College went to the voters, and the voters actually agreed to pay more so that they could educate more students. So we have a supplement. Thank God Proposition 30 passed, so we're not going to see the hits that we've seen in the past. So hopefully we're starting to recover. Is there anyone else on this item? If not, I'd like to go to the – oh, sir? Come on.
I'm Harvey Goldberg. And I just wanted to say I agree with that gentleman. When I got out of high school, I had taken wood shop, auto shop. I knew how to do things with my hands and also was ready to go forward in life and get a job. And nowadays, everyone's got a smartphone in their hand, it seems. And I think I saw yesterday on the news that there's something now called No Phone Nobia or something. And that's everyone's hooked on it. People are going, they get in the shower with their smartphone. But some lady said she gets in the shower, she goes to the bathroom. When she gets up, she's afraid to not have it in her hand. And it's becoming a real problem. But I agree with you with I look forward to something that would go to the schooling system, the educational system, that would bring auto shop and bring these things back into the system more.
Thank you very much. So you, yes, John?
I just want to make a comment. I appreciate the speakers. I do think we need to acknowledge two things. One is, yes, we need to spend more, have more investment in bringing in having training for these kind of jobs. But at the same time, we need to recognize that there are less and less of those types of jobs in the Bay Area as we move forward. So we also have an obligation to train and educate folks growing up in the Bay Area to be able to access the new jobs in the growing industries in tech. So we have to do both. We can't close our eyes and say we're going to bring all manufacturing back and we're going to train people for those jobs. If we look at the trend, we want to preserve the manufacturing jobs we have. We want to train people for those jobs. But at the same time, we need to adjust to the changing economy and ensure that we are raising people to a higher standard to be able to take the new jobs. So I just wanted to acknowledge, not to have a discussion about that, but just to acknowledge that those are both important.
I wouldn't make it a discussion. I would say, would you like me to form a committee, and maybe you could get me a pension or something with
thank you, sir.
You know, a salary and a pension to go along with your ideas.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Julie, did you want to make a comment?
Just real quickly, I would just mention that at the Prosperity Committee meeting that we held, one of the discussion points that we will be following up on is this whole concept of bringing business together and hopefully encouraging them to partner with the education community so that the businesses can actually make sure that whatever they need in training is incorporated into the schools and perhaps even go so far as to sponsor that education by providing the instructors and the equipment that is needed for whatever that specialized technical skill is, and bringing those into those schools where we particularly need to raise the level of education.
Sean would like to comment about this. I was under the impression, Sean, that on this discussion that there were a lot of people who are in the skilled jobs, blue-collar jobs, who are reaching retirement age, and that there's a huge problem fulfilling those people who have the skills. So, you know, people who can work a computer, people who can technically train, not necessarily college trained.
I think everybody's right in this case, that there's a lot of people retiring or will be retiring in the next 10 years who have a historically high education and skill level. So they'll need to be replaced at least the same, if not a higher skill level. That a lot of the sort of technical jobs that are going to be out there, and I think part of the problem is we've, and this came out earlier today too, that there's more jobs at the bottom of the system that are relatively low paid and not as well educated folks. There's a lot of jobs at the top end of the system and growing of well paid, highly educated, competitive folks. And there's fewer in the middle. And I think that's where a lot of the shakiness is sort of developing in the system, those middle tier skilled jobs, and that's where the biggest gaps are showing up. So when we talk about like career technical education, I think absolutely some community colleges are doing a great job working with their local industries. If we could just spread that more systematically throughout the area, but those skills, I'm sure they're, I know because I pay these guys a lot of money. We need people to repair cars, but nowadays those people probably need to have computer skills because so much of the technology in cars is computer-based. So it's really just a matter of having the systems that enable us to keep up with the state of skills required by industry. So it's really all of the above.
Thank you. And speaking of retirement, okay, Mark.
Maybe the obvious question is that there's sort of, we're great at creating new ideas, but then once the manufacturing is identified, it moves offshore, and that seems to be where a lot of those middle-income jobs would otherwise normally be. You know, what can we in the Bay Area do to perhaps bring some of the middle-income manufacturing jobs rather than just the service jobs to the Bay Area?
Manufacturing is really a fascinating question because there's a national focus the Obama administration is getting into. A lot of people are thinking about it. It's called advanced manufacturing. The definition of manufacturing is changing. It's become much more technologically focused than it ever was before. I think the reality, and this is not just in the Bay Area, but it's around the country and everywhere in the world, actually, let's say the Bay Area in California, that we are still an enormous manufacturing center. If you look at the amount of value added contributed to the economy by manufacturing, it's really big. It's mostly computer-related technology manufacturing. Not all of it is, but it mostly is. The trick is the contribution of manufacturing per se is really big, but the employment is not growing. So, you know, we're just doing a lot of the same stuff with very, very few people because of technology. So I think where that takes you is we really need manufacturing as part of a balanced economy. It supports a lot of stuff. If you do manufacturing, a lot of the R&D wants to be close to the manufacturing because that's where it gets applied. If you lose the manufacturing, there's more risk that the R&D eventually bleeds off to China to be close to the manufacturing there. So for a healthy economy, you need it. We got to train people with the skills to do that. Some manufacturing isn't here that could be because they actually can't find the people with the skills to do those jobs anymore. So that's one reason they leave. But it's not going to be a big source of new jobs. But it's a necessary part of a sort of a healthy, balanced economy we need to try to keep. Most of this manufacturing, and this has been true for a long time, it's not assembly stuff and it's not mass manufacturing. It's relatively small scale, very advanced technology-oriented manufacturing that it tends to be fairly early in the production process. You know, we'll probably never have a big assembly plant here in our lifetimes, ever. But what we do well competitively is sophisticated, high-end, low-volume, high-value manufacturing, and I think that's where our jobs are going to be in that area, and that's what we have to train for.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So I was speaking of retiring. We go to our next item, which is Will Travis has decided to retire, as you may all know, by the end of January. And at the January 18th meeting of the JPC, the executive staff agency executive staff and the PUC, JPC executive committee will provide a recommendation on the scope of the staff consultant support that will be needed for the JPC for 2013 and how that support will be provided to the JPC and how the staff consultant should be recruited and selected. So that will be put forward at our next meeting. Trout, do you want to make a comment here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, well, first off, it has been absolutely an honor to work with all of you, and particularly with Chairman Bates, and I'm really proud of what we've accomplished over the past year. In particular, I think we can take pride in the fact that we've moved from having no process prescribed for managing JPC responsibilities to having clear policies on JPC management, coordination and collaboration, regional leadership, and engagement with the business community. At your last meeting, you put these policies to work when you unanimously decided to take on a leadership role in tackling the controversial and difficult job of formulating a regional sea level rise adaptation strategy. You hired me last February, and my contract comes up for renewal at the end of January. And while I was enjoying my vacation in Tuscany, a vacation that had to be postponed twice so I could deal with my responsibilities for you, to you, I decided I did not want to renew my contract. As you probably know, I retired from my position as BCDC's executive director at the end of last year. I'd hoped I'd be able to enjoy my retirement, devote some time to other activities that I really like engaging in, and serve as a policy advisor to you. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to do all of these things, so I've decided to try again to retire. So as the chairman explained, over the next couple of months, we'll be working on the best ways of doing this and provide recommendations to you at your January meeting. I really do sincerely thank you for the opportunity you've provided to me to serve you, and I look forward to engaging in my own personal regional economic development strategy, which is providing a job opportunity to somebody else. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Travis. You're going to be missed. So we're now going to committee comments, and I'd like to welcome our two new members from ABAG, Mark and Julie. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was nice to fix that problem that we had with our chair and vice chair, president and vice president, not being part of that. So with the number of folks moving out, we're able to fill a couple spots and look forward to working with you more engaged on the JPC now.
Julie?
Yeah, under committee comment, I just would like to make a suggestion for the agendas for this group that maybe one of the very first things on the agenda as a standing item would be a report out from the executive committee. It's been mentioned a couple of times throughout the meeting that the executive committee did things. I think we need to make that a standing item so that everybody knows right up front in the meeting what the executive committee actually was dealing with and what their actions might have been, just so that nobody feels left out of the process.
I think that's an excellent suggestion, especially since I'm leaving. Okay. Thank you very much. Anyway, Peter London has a new book. Peter, do you want to come forward and indicate this is in public comments? Peter is one of my constituents, and he's done a book about the Centers for the Bay Area, Walkable Communities on Transit.
Thanks very much. This is a book which is the product of observation of these regional processes over 20 or so years, and it comes from the segment of your observers who would like to see you go faster, go more quickly on climate change and generally modernization of the economy and society here. It proposes that close and operational funded attention be given to intense development around transit as a way of getting away from the huge burden on everybody's lives of an automobilized and sprawling society. I hope you'll give it a reading and a fair shot.
Thank you. Does anyone else in the public wish to address the JPC? Okay, it's been a pleasure to act as your chair for the last year and a half, and I wish John Joy all the best, and working together, I'm sure we're going to continue to make improvements in our economy. So thanks for coming, and see you in January.
We are ready to go.